the French cow is le mu. The British cow goes mu. I say mu. The Italian cow goes mwah, mwah.
Ducks and monkeys sound a lot alike, don't they? I agree with that.
Oh, gosh. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. My apologies for that opening. I didn't plan that. That was a joke from my producer here, my board op. Welcome to the show, and I look forward to talking with you here in the next couple of hours on anything that's in the area of ethics, values, and religion. I'm here live and lively, kicking off September here on the 3rd of September. And I'm glad you're part of our listening audience. I hope you're part of our calling audience at 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150 is my local number. And we just got a call a couple of hours ago before we got here from a soldier in Iraq. So apparently he hadn't figured out the time zones correctly. And if he can stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning his time, he's going to be calling back to raise his questions and to offer his point of view. As you're welcome to do here, once again, those numbers, 1-800-227-5278 and in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Have a couple of quick items here for your consideration before we get rolling with the calls. And one is just a bit of a confession. I had a little bit of a rough go this morning after church. Went into a restaurant, my wife and I, with my little baby, and we were carrying our Starbucks coffee. We like our coffee. It doesn't have to be Starbucks. In fact, Starbucks is not my favorite, but it is strong and it is rich. And it's, it stays on the palate for a while, which is what we like. And so it is very rare that you can find any restaurant that serves coffee that good. So we usually go and get either Starbucks or Pete's or something to our liking and bring it into the restaurant and almost never have a problem. In fact, it's been a long, long time since anybody has raised an eyebrow about that. People do it all the time. And in this case, we walked in, and the young lady announced to us that we would not be able to bring our beverages in. We could step outside and finish them if we'd like, and then she'd seat us at the restaurant, at which I turned on my heel immediately and said, we'll go somewhere else, and mentioned and then added, you just lost a lot of money for the sake of two cups of coffee, and marched out. Now, I'll tell you, quite frankly, I wasn't very proud of my behavior. Not that I marched out, but I was just a little bit rough on her, I guess, curt. And I asked my wife just as we walked out. She followed me dutifully. And then I said, was I a little hard on her? And she said, yes. And then we talked about it a little bit. And, of course, it's sometimes in after the fact that we remember what's required of being a good ambassador. Remember, we're on 24/7, right? And I didn't know this young lady, but I had mistreated her. And so there were two concerns on my mind. One was that I was a representative of Christ and had not been a good example of that. And we've talked about being a good ambassador many times and what that involves and the fact that we're on 24/7 and we are communicating about our faith and our God and our Savior when we're out. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:20, as though God were speaking through us, we beg of you in behalf of Christ be reconciled to God. In other words, the ambassador is the stand-in who speaks for the sovereign. And so when we act for good or for ill, that reflects on our sovereign. And so there I was, not being a very good ambassador. I'm sharing this account not so much because I'm proud of this. Obviously, I'm not. But it happens to me, and I'm sure it does to you, and maybe this is a reminder to you to be more careful too. The second problem, of course, was that regardless of being an ambassador, I had mistreated this young lady. It was mild. It was modest. I was just curt and rude, and I was turned on my heel and said my thing and was out the door. But, when you act that way towards someone. This young lady must have been 17 years old or maybe younger. She was a hostess. She said, well, I'm just doing what I was told to do. God bless her, which she was. It wasn't her policy. She wasn't the manager. So I might have, in being curt to her, might have ruined her whole day. You know how when somebody's nasty to you and then you get mad or you get hurt or the combination, and it can linger with you for a while. Well, it lingered with me as I was feeling, the conviction of the Spirit. But I felt it pretty quickly. That's why I addressed this with my wife and then purposed to go back after our breakfast at another location to come back and apologize to the young lady, which I did. And she is very gracious. But I said, you know, I'm sorry. I was rude to you. And that wasn't right. It's not your fault. Now, I'm not sorry for walking out and taking my business elsewhere. But I am sorry for the way I treated you. So I felt better. She felt better. She dismissed it fairly easily. Oh, that's okay. Don't worry about it. She dismissed it very quickly, and I don't know, maybe I made her feel better, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe she just let it roll off like she has to with a lot of other abrupt, curt, maybe rude customers, but I didn't want to be one of them. And so I went back and repaired that situation. Just something for you to think about. We're all in the game here together, and we all make those kind of mistakes. And it is within our power to fix them, and we ought to. When we do that. Fortunately, I had a good wife who gave me good feedback, and many of you have spouses that can help you to know when you make the same kind of blunders. I have more to say, but we have our Baghdad caller here, so let's go right away to Eugene and welcome him to the show. Eugene, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Fine. Calling all the way from Baghdad.
Yes.
And you're serving there in what service?
I'm with the U.S. Army.
Good for you. What do you do there?
I'm a signal officer. Mm-hmm. I deal with communications, which is actually why I can call back to the States.
Well, it's good. Well, I'm glad that you did, and thank you for your service. And I'd love to hear what you have. We're actually honored that you would call us here at Stand to Reason. I think you're the first soldier from Iraq that's called us on the air, and I appreciate that. Do you know of other soldiers that are listening, or are you a rare one?
I believe I'm a rare one, but I'm trying to spread the word more so out here.
Okay, good. Well, that's good. How can I help you today, Eugene?
Oh, not at all. Like I said, first I wanted to say how great your ministry has been for me, at least out here.
Uh-huh.
It's been difficult to attend services, to do the things that are normally due, obviously, back in the States.
Mm-hmm. Is that because of restrictions there? Is that because of restrictions by those in Iraq, or a kind of maybe a hypersensitivity to the religious climate there? Or is that because there just aren't that many Christians around you, and they don't make that kind of stuff available in the circumstances you're in, or maybe you're in a war zone, and therefore it's just complicated?
Right, it's more of a logistical problem.
Uh-huh.
Of, you know, being out in the field, not being able to, I don't know, get to church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not too many churches out there either, right? They're in a tent somewhere.
Right.
Yeah. So, by the way, are you...
There's great chaplains that do a wonderful job, but even then it's hard because you're doing mission-oriented stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, is your MOS, your military specialty, which is radio operator or communications, does that bring you in line of fire there, or are you kind of at command post or something and that isn't such a concern?
Right. I mean...
Or maybe everybody's in the line of fire there.
I'm in the rear with the gear, as they say.
But in the rear with the gear. I guess there's a sense in which everybody's kind of in the line of fire there because nobody's very far away from the bad guys, and they can infiltrate. And I mean, it's like Vietnam. You know, you never knew who's going to blow you up next. It could be a kid, and I know you have their minds there and all kinds of other things that you have to contend with. So,
correct. I mean, they call it 360-degree battle.
Yeah.
Field. I mean, there's no official, like, front line as in the old times.
Just out of curiosity, if you don't mind me asking, and if you're not at liberty to talk about this, just personally, how is it, you know, your position there as a soldier, I understand you get Fox News and CNN and newspapers. In other words, you have access to that in different places. How does the news coverage that we characteristically get compared to what you experienced there in Baghdad on a day-to-day? How long have you been there, by the way?
I've been here since April of last year, actually.
April of 2005?
Right.
You've been there for a year and a half?
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Okay. Well, how do the
by
news...
By choice, though. I mean, I've extended on my own.
Oh, good for you.
Right.
Okay, gotcha. How do the news reports compare that you get from the West about the East? How do they compare with your experience in the East firsthand?
It's, you know, the war is a little different now in 2006. I mean, we actually get CNN out here. Mm-hmm. We get the Fox News and newspapers of all sorts. It gets a little frustrating at times because we see it, you know. I mean, I don't want to go into too deep detail, but it's just
right.
News always focuses on the bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is what it is, and you know, they obviously have a choice to show what they want to show, and you know, we see a different light, I think,
mm-hmm.
in a lot of things. I mean, part of the reasons why I did extend is for that reason. I mean, you know, when they say, oh, well, all the Jews want to go back and all these things, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, we all, it's not like we have a draft like in the old days. I mean, mm-hmm. it is a volunteer army. We mm-hmm. choose to, you know, choose the occupation that we
right.
died. And so,
how's things changed in the last 18 months? You mentioned that. Things are different now. Now you have more access to the Western news, is that it, than you did early on? Is that what you meant?
Well, no, I mean, a lot is, I can't go into too much detail.
Sure, of course.
A lot of the work I'm doing is giving availability to the internet,
mm-hmm.
communication, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a lot more accessible. And
I gotcha.
As a result, we can just see a lot more things and stuff like that.
And you can listen to Stand to Reason online.
Right, exactly. Or I download it.
Well, that's good. Okay, those are just personal questions that I had, and we are deeply honored by your call and by your service there. But I know you had some questions that you thought maybe I could help you out with, Eugene. So how can I help
sure.
you?
Sure. Oh, yeah, well... like I was saying, I do enjoy listening to your show as often as I can out here.
Good.
It's been really good. The questions I had is this, you know, we have chaplains here. It's been great as far as the ministry is concerned and as far as spiritual needs are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And basically my question is about ordination and the biblical view of ordination and how, you know, here's my specific question, basically. I had no real knowledge of the fact that, you know, when they say ordained ministers all the time, recently as much as, you know, Reggie White.
Right.
But I also had assumed that there was a standard for ordination across the board, which I'm coming to realize is not the case.
No.
And then... being that that's not the case, then what is a good standard?
What is ordination? What's the standard? Okay, let me try to answer that first. Ordination,
correct.
Licensing and ordination are official ways of identifying somebody that has made, in a sense, a career or a significant step towards major involvement in ministry, all right? Licensing is something that the state is concerned with because if you're going to marry or bury, you need to get a license, and then you get certain tax breaks. Ordination is usually a function of a local denomination or a particular denomination, so you are ordained in the Presbyterian Church USA or in the Southern Baptist Convention or whatever. And then that is more of a kind of a that's more on the spiritual side. I mean, it's one is the government's concern about the licensing. The ordination is the way when a denomination acknowledges that you've been set apart for a full-time ministry. Now, there is no there are no requirements that need to be fulfilled for those in particular, except for the requirements of the particular denomination for ordination. As long as you have a sponsoring body, like a legitimate church in the eyes of the state who want to license you as one of their workers, that can be done. That's pro forma. That's just filling out the forms and it's done. I'm a licensed minister, for example, and I get the license for legal reasons and tax reasons. It doesn't give any actual spiritual legitimacy to me. It just shows the state that I followed their rules, and therefore they give me a tax break. That's the big advantage to that. And plus, some people care about those things. So if you're in the work and you say, well, I'm a licensed minister, then they think that somehow this is more significant. However, notice that everything that I've said so far about licensing and ordination has to do with a human perspective on things. There is no such thing as licensing or ordination from God's perspective, and there's a very good reason for that. In other words, the Bible is silent about these things. And the reason is because in the New Testament, every single Christian was a full-time minister, regardless of whether he made some money at it or not. This was somewhat irrelevant to the question of one's spiritual commitment. And it has only been 2,000 years of kind of a distortion of the notion that we have migrated back to, in many cases, a sense of professional ministry where you have ordained ministers and pastors and youth leaders and priests, etc., who get paid for the work, and they are the full-time ministers and the rest of us are the lay people. And this is not a biblical distinction, and it really has caused some problem in the church, Eugene, because sometimes people get the idea, well, it's their job. We're paying them to do the work of the ministry, so I give them my tithe. They run the service, and they take care of the gospel and all that other stuff, you know. They do the work. When it sounds like, you know, this isn't a biblical pattern. The biblical pattern is the body of Christ does the work, and the professionals, insofar as they're professional, are there to train. Actually, what it says in Ephesians 4 is those gifted men, evangelists, pastors, teachers, etc., are there to train the body of Christ for the work of service. They're like drill sergeants, in a sense, in your own experience. The drill sergeants don't fight the war. I mean, they were out there probably under fire themselves, so they're more effective at training you how to do it, but they don't fight the battles. They teach you to fight the battles. And that's the way it is in the church. The people who are the gifted men, whether or not they make a living at it or not, the gifted people in the body are those with those specific gifts are to teach the rest and to train them for works of service in the body of Christ. So that's in Ephesians 4. If you want to text, and if you read that whole chapter, I think you'll get a sense of it there. But
correct.
Okay. Does that make sense to you about the ordination?
It does. My concern with it is this. In regards to a church body, then, the overseer of it should be ordained, you feel, correct?
No, I don't think an overseer has to be ordained. Remember, ordaining is a construction of human beings, and it serves some purpose among human beings. And I think originally it was kind of meant to qualify them for the kind of service that they're going into according to some of the guidelines that overseers are to be qualified for. But it doesn't always function that way, quite frankly, and because a lot of times it's not those guidelines that they're looking at but other guidelines. And maybe they've graduated from seminary or something like that, and you can't get ordained unless you graduate from seminary. Well, that's not a biblical requirement. They need to be able to teach, and a lot of people who graduated from seminary can't teach. And correct and whatever, or they don't do that. So I think that if a person is to be installed in leadership as an elder, oversight of the church, they have to fulfill the requirements of Titus and Timothy, but nothing more than that. It doesn't hurt, you know, if they got further education than is required there. That's fine. And if you want to go through a ceremony to establish them in this role and call it ordination, I'm not against it in itself, but I think it has the liabilities of kind of drawing a line between the professionals and the non-professionals, and I think that can be a liability to the church. Does that make sense?
All right, great.
Okay, Eugene, I know you have another question about Christianity and work. Can I hold you over to the next segment?
Yeah, by all means.
Okay, I'll because that's also very relevant to where you're at. I'm putting you on hold here. That's Eugene in Baghdad, a soldier who is fighting and serving the United States there as a Christian, and now has some questions about Christianity and war, which is understandable. So we'll get back to that in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Clear Thinking Christianity. Stand to reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Careful, intelligent discussion about ethics, values, and religion. Greg Kokel here giving you a piece of my mind today and taking calls 1-800-227-5278. Our first call today is actually our first call from Iraq, indeed in Baghdad itself, and Eugene is calling there. It's, what time in the morning is it, Eugene?
It's actually 2:20.
Now, are you usually up this time? Or are you on the swing shift, or is this bedtime for you, usually?
Actually, yeah, normally it's bedtime, but it is not that we ever get holidays off here, but tomorrow is Labor Day, but at least we can sleep in a little more.
Well, it's good. I always wondered why people get Labor Day off. I thought they call it Labor Day for a reason, but you should be laboring on Labor Day. I'm going to be laboring on Labor Day. But you had another question about Christianity and war. And, of course, this strikes very close to home, given the fact that you're soldiering right now, yeah, and a follower of Christ.
Sure. And, you know, it's I guess it's more of a pertinent question out here, but one of the greater opportunities I've had out here is the chance to talk more about Christianity as a whole. And
right.
By and large, you know, there's a quote that they all say, you know, there are no atheists in a foxhole.
Mm-hmm. That's an old quote, by the way. It's been around for a long time.
Right. Right, exactly.
And so you have opportunity. No, go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, I was saying, yeah, and because of the reality situation, you know, people are more open to talk about.
Yeah, there's ultimate issues. I mean, people are facing life and death circumstances every day. It's staring you in the face, and so it's kind of hard to avoid the eternal questions, and so you kind of have a wonderful opportunity. By the way, just out of curiosity, what is the spiritual climate among soldiers there? Is there a sense of, like around here in campus and everything, there's just a sense of apathy about spiritual things? Or do you find that the soldiers are more spiritually sensitized and that is more interested in spiritual things for the reasons that we just mentioned and therefore are much more open to have spiritual conversations or something in between?
Yeah, I think you hit it pretty accurately. The Army is pretty much still a microcosm of, you know, the real world back in the States. And I think those who are active are more active out here.
Mm-hmm. You mean those who are active as Christians are a little bit more motivated
there?
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
But those that are, you know, what would you say, C&E Christians are more apt to be more active as a result. And
wait, what kind of Christians? I missed that.
Oh, I don't know. I call them C&E Christians. Christmas and Easter.
Oh, I see. So, in other words, people who may be just going through the cultural actions here in the States where it doesn't cost them anything, all of a sudden now they're out there where, gee, things are a lot tougher, and it makes them more serious about the religious convictions that they only held maybe in a very light and unserious way when they were in the States. Is that what you mean?
Correct.
Oh, good.
Exactly.
Like you said,
it's a challenge. I think partly because we work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, usually.
Yeah.
So the few times you have off, it's just difficult, whether you want to attend church or not and stuff. So I think just the situation out here causes issues as far as actually, doing a Bible study or your quiet times or whatever it may be. And so that's challenging. But there is definitely an openness as far as, talking about God and religion and philosophy out here.
And I guess it's kind of hard to say, hard for people to argue that all religions are equally valid when they're fighting Islamofascism and terrorism, huh?
That's an excellent point, and it's one that's being abundantly made clear out here, which is, it is. It opens your eyes to a lot of it. I mean, you're entirely correct. I mean, we talk about religious tolerance and this whole religious pluralism and everything, and
religious tolerance is a good thing. We have that in the States. That is, we tolerate other religions and we allow people to practice their religion freely. That's different from saying that all religions are equally true. That is intolerance. That's foolishness. And though there's a lot of people who have the freedom to be fools in this country, and more power to them. But they're making a big mistake, it seems to me.
Exactly. And this whole region is just a proof of your point, I think. And it, a lot of people are realizing it, at least I know I am, more so from being out here.
What's the question about war that's come up? Has there been some challenges about how can you be a Christian and fight a war? Or
exactly. For the most part, yeah. And I'm pretty good at it. I mean, but it's still hard to, I guess, good reasoning.
Okay, let me offer you a couple of thoughts, Eugene. I'll give you the way I deal with this, and let me try to deal with broad strokes so it gives you kind of an outline in your mind, all right?
Right.
And the simple point that I want to make is that God is not a pacifist. Now, how do I know this? Because God sent people to war. I mean, this is just any cursory reading of the Bible. You can't miss this if you read the Bible. Okay, and so you might ask somebody, you said, does the God of the Bible ever send any people to war? Yes. Well, then God's not a pacifist. Now, it may be that some wars are not just wars and they're not justified, but to say that all war is wrong in the eyes of God is obviously false because God sent people to war. So I'd want to make the point first that God is not a pacifist because the Old Testament is filled with examples of God sending the Jews to war. Now, the rejoinder to that point would be Jesus. Well, Jesus changed that. And then I'm going to ask where. And they're going to say probably, do you know where people usually suggest?
No.
They usually go to the Sermon on the Mount. And they suggest, well, Jesus said we shouldn't fight, we should turn the other cheek. But if you look at the turn the other cheek passage clearly, here's what it says. It says, anyone who slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the left as well. All right? That's what he said.
Right.
Okay, so are most people right-handed or left-handed?
You're right-handed.
Okay, so if I'm going to slap somebody with my right hand, which cheek do I usually hit on the other person?
Their left cheek.
I hit their left cheek. So how do you slap somebody on the right cheek with a right hand?
I don't know.
Backhanded.
Oh, with yourself, right?
With your back hand. The back of your hand. The front of your hand hits their left side. The back of your hand hits their right. The front of your hand is for delivering a serious blow. The backhand isn't for dealing a serious blow. You don't have any strength that way. What are you doing when you're hitting somebody with the back of your hand? You're insulting them.
Right.
So Jesus' point here is about taking action against personal insult. He is not talking about pacifism here. He is not just talking about laying down and letting anybody do anything. He said if they strike you on the right cheek, turn the left to them also. In other words, if they want to slap you and say nasty things about you or insult you, don't go after them. And this is what the Jews were doing. They were saying an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They were taking personal vengeance from a principle that was really meant to be a principle of law. That is, if the guy, commits a capital crime, you give him capital punishment. If he commits a small crime, you give him a small punishment. That's the eye for the eye and the tooth for a tooth. It means that the punishment should fit the crime. But they were taking this aggressive response out on people who were just offending them, okay? So the point I'm making here is in the Bible, God is a God of war, all right? He's not a God of peace. He's not a pacifist God that no war is legitimate. And Jesus didn't change that. In fact, when Jesus was slapped himself at the trial, he didn't turn the other cheek. He demanded an accounting. He said, for what did you slap me? He said, if I spoke wrong, bear witness of the wrong. And if I didn't, then why did you strike me?
Right.
So I think Jesus' teaching, properly understood, should not be taken as pacifist teaching. All right? So that would be the argument, the basic argument I'd offer them, to demonstrate that there is nothing inconsistent with war and God. Not necessarily inconsistent. Now, some wars are wrong, but there's going to be a need for war. And I'll tell you why. Because God, the Christian worldview, God takes seriously man's fallenness and therefore the need for something like lethal response to aggression. If man wasn't fallen, we wouldn't need this. But the fact that man is fallen, what's the choice? People say, well, violence never solves anything. Baloney.
Right.
Violence solves all kinds of things. Now, there's a price to pay, but sometimes that's the only price that can be paid to solve this serious problem.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense to me. And a lot of the points you brought up are a lot of points that I bring up. The only, I guess, they get down into specifics of killing, someone now. I mean, into the actual fact of
taking another human life.
Correct.
But that's the same issue, really. I mean, war isn't just an abstract. When we say God was a God who sent people into war, he didn't want people to go in there and just beat their drums and scare the heck out of people, then they run away and they didn't have to draw blood. He sent them into war to draw blood, to kill people.
Right.
And he did that time and time again. So when we say that war can be legitimate, what we mean by that, war is just a broad term to account for or to describe in the term the killing of many people, to subjugate an army or the bad guys so that they stop doing the bad they're doing. So the fact that God is not a God of peace in the sense that all war is wrong is another way of saying that God says sometimes it's not only necessary to kill people, it is the right thing to do to kill people.
Right.
It's morally necessary. Now, it's tragic after a certain fashion. It's tragic that the world is such a place where that has to happen, but it still is necessary. And by the way, that doesn't mean at all that when we do the right thing, and that may mean go to war, that it doesn't exact a toll on the people who have to carry that out, an emotional one as well as a physical one. The physical one is obvious, but there are people who have to do undercover stuff, and you know more about this than I do, and they got to do some pretty spooky things. And, it's a dirty business. But sometimes the dirty business is the morally required thing to do, even though it's injurious. And I think sometimes people don't understand this. Like, you look at, if I go out and kill 10 people, then that'll injure my soul. Well, it will. Because, you know, human beings are valuable, and to take that life, it's tragic, but it needs to be done, but it still can injure the individual who's doing it. But if you go out in battle, you can be physically injured too. I mean, to do the right thing may mean you put yourself in harm's way, not just physically, but emotionally. But it doesn't mean that it's not the right thing to do.
Right.
And there are times when it is just the right thing to do something that that compared to a perfect world would be tragic, but it still is better than the alternative. But the alternative is alternative is inaction, and consequently, more innocent people get killed. You know, I wonder how many people just did the math as to how many innocent people died during the reign of Saddam Hussein. You know, I know there's 3,000 soldiers were killed, American soldiers here, since this battle started. I think we crossed that number recently. But there were a lot more than 3,000 people dying, and maybe on a monthly basis or even shorter than that, month after month, year after year, for, what, 18 years while Saddam was in reign there. And so not to act and not to put our bodies in harm's way means that many, many more innocent people would actually perish. And it's a richness to all of us that there are people like you, Eugene, and many of them who are willing to put your bodies in harm's way, not just in the abstract for freedom for Americans, because we're a long way away, although this is there is a close connection because terrorism is worldwide, but for the freedom even of the people that you serve there and maybe don't always appreciate it, I don't know, but you are putting your bodies in harm's way for them too, lest they die under oppressive regimes. So
no, you know, that's entirely accurate, and I think part of the reasons why I extended also is the people I meet here. I mean, I'm talking the local, national people.
Mm-hmm. The rank and file, you mean? The rank and file Iraqis is what you mean, right?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by and large, obviously I haven't met all of them, but mm-hmm. the majority of the ones that I have met, you know, are... because when you look at the terrorist attacks, and yes, we have lost a lot of our own soldiers, but by and large, you know, they're killing Iraqis more than anything else.
That's right.
And they're the ones more upset. I mean, you know, they don't want the terrorism any more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's kind of weird how it's kind of backfiring. They're, you know, on their goal, I guess, the terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they're trying to push it, but it's kind of, there's a lot of Iraqis that are... you know, glad to have us here to fight.
Mm-hmm.
To fight.
And you can say that because you're not a newbie. You're in your second tour here, and so you've been around for a while. You can, from experience, you know this to be the case. Well, Eugene, thank you so much. We're going to have to go here, but I deeply appreciate your call and your service and your sacrifice and your hard work on behalf of the kingdom, seeing this opportunity to be a better ambassador for Christ and calling in to get some help. There you go. That's for you and all your boys. So, call anytime, Eugene.
All right. Thanks again, Greg. I appreciate your time.
All the best. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now.
That was a sweet call, ladies and gentlemen. And, I hope you were touched as much as I was in that. And the simple, straightforward comments of this hardworking soldier in Iraq and hardworking Christian soldier says so much more than I could say in just hours and hours in talking about it. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Stay with us for another segment. I'll be back in a moment.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Greg Kochel, demonstrating once again that Christianity is worth thinking about. And taking your calls at 1-800-227-5278 on the heels of a very touching call from a soldier in Baghdad who called us direct here. And if you missed that, be sure to download the MP3 file. It should be up tomorrow afternoon, or actually it might be a day late because of Labor Day. When we post, yeah, Tuesday, check that. Let's go to Lucky, and welcome to the show, Lucky.
Hi, Greg. How's it going?
Okay, you got to follow that that wonderful call, huh?
I really wanted to thank Eugene. I didn't know how all this radio stuff works. But, yeah, it's awesome he's there. I wish I could be with him. Mm. I'm actually in the Army myself. I've been in for about 6 years.
Oh, really? Where are you stationed?
Schofield Barracks, Hawaii.
Okay. You're suffering for the Lord there on Oahu, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I used to teach tennis there at Schofield Barracks back in 1974. I was doing ministry there in the summer of 74 and 75.
Oh, wow.
So I know the place well.
Okay.
Okay. Welcome to the show, Lucky.
Oh, thanks. I really...
And thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. I'm coming up to kind of a pivotal point in my life. Over the last several months, I've been going through a lot of issues. I've been praying about it. I've been seeking God's guidance in it. And just kind of along that route, I kind of came across your show, and I've been listening by podcast for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm troubled by I hate the word pacifist. I do. But for lack of a better word, well, actually, there's a better word. But I am one of those who believes that war is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I look more towards the New Testament than the Old. And I do think that the Old Testament can be explained as to why God sent people to war, and I realize that he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you'd agree that war isn't wrong. It just may be wrong in certain cases, because if war was wrong in itself, then God would be wrong for sending people to war. So do you mean that war isn't wrong in itself, but the circumstances that we face since Jesus' time is... Pardon me?
I cannot find the justification to take another man's life. I know that war happens. It's not. Nothing I do or anybody else is going to do is going to take that away from the world. But as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus Christ, as a person who is seeking to discern Christ's path in my life,
right,
I cannot find the justification in the New Testament to do that.
Okay, well, let me just back up for a second because, I respect your view there, and I think you've made it clear now. So let's just work through this a little bit. And, I mean, did you want to ask me about this, or did you just want to tell me that you're troubled by my position, or do you want to hear a defense for it, or what do you want at this point?
I've actually kind of made a couple notes of things I've come across in reading some of your writings.
Okay.
I was deeply troubled by the reasoning you made in a paper that is on the website, not titled "War with Iraq," and you made the assumption—not I don't think it's the assumption—but you made a statement: Troops have only two functions. One, to destroy life or property. Two, to threaten or destroy either life or property. And since the second threat is a non-viable without the actual intent to follow through, both functions are effectively reduced to one.
Mm-hmm.
Destruction.
Mm-hmm.
I have applied to be a conscientious objector, and I did not apply for discharge because I do believe that I can go to war and support the people who may not act according to what I believe in. I fully believe that I can show love, compassion, mercy, and grace to people no matter what they believe.
Well, I think all of those things are true. I'm not sure where your objection with me is, because even though you may not want to go to war and may find peaceful ways of being supportive or making an influence, my statement was about military in general. And I don't see where what I said was, I mean, the purpose of...
And I'm a troop.
Okay.
That's why it hit me so hard, is that my intent is not death and destruction. My intent, like God's, is redemption. And I don't think that that is the only purpose I can serve in the military.
Okay, but I wasn't saying that there can be no individual person who doesn't do death and destruction. I was making a statement about the nature of armies. Sometimes you have cooks in armies, and cooks in armies don't kill anybody. They feed food, but they serve the larger purpose of the army, which is to destroy things and kill people. And if the army didn't destroy things or kill people, it wouldn't be an army, and it wouldn't be able to do what armies do. That was the point that I was making. That there is a purpose for armies, and that's true about the armies, even though not every single individual in an army draws blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could be working in some capacity where maybe you fix carburetors on trucks or something, or maybe you are a cook or something like that. Pardon me?
I'm actually in an infantry platoon. I'm a forward observer for the artillery.
Okay, well, you're a forward observer for the artillery? That means you tell where the bombs hit and how to zero in more closely on the targets they're shooting at. Is that right?
That is correct. That's why I couldn't continue in that capacity.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now I understand. I got you. Because of your conscientious objector status, then you want to. All right. Well, I don't have any beef with your individual, you know, conscientious objector status, but you made an objection about something I wrote there, and I still don't see what was wrong with what I wrote, and there still is this...
I don't think it was an objection. I think it spoke to me in a way that I wasn't comfortable with, because I felt like you were saying that troops, their function is to kill and destroy.
It is. It is. Taken as a whole. That's what militaries are for, and if they didn't... It's like policemen. Policemen are...
I understand.
Pardon me?
If we can label it as a generalization, I believe... that I could understand.
Okay, I actually think it was pretty obvious as a generalization, but if it wasn't, then just take it as such. I'm talking about it's like the nature of the police force. The nature of the police force is to enforce the law. Not every single policeman is involved enforcing the law. Some of them are pushing paper around. Some of them are sweeping floors. I mean, the people that are working for the force. But the purpose of the force is to do this, and by the same token, the purpose of military is to do as I described, and I still stand behind that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I am concerned about your understanding that you can find no justification for ever taking life in the New Testament. The New Testament is built on the Old, and unless the New Testament abrogates something taught in the Old, the things in the Old still stand. God sent people to war. There was capital punishment in the Old Testament. None of these things have been abrogated. Well, let me just finish the thought for just a second, and I'll let you jump in, Lucky, okay? Certainly capital punishment was not abrogated in the New Testament. Nothing Jesus said can be construed to do that. And wars themselves were not. I mean, there's no speaking against war in the New Testament at all. Now, if what you mean is I can't find any New Testament verse that further advances the legitimacy of war, that might be true, but only because there was no occasion to speak directly to that issue. And I would say there's a presumption that the other ethic from the Old Testament is still in place in principle, and so there's no reason to speak to it. Jesus had other goals. So go ahead. What do you disagree with on what I just said?
I think sometimes the analogy can be made that the Old and New Testament are like software versions. The Old, you build it upon. It's the base. It's the foundation. Everything else that comes after has to draw from it. But the updates to the version get rid of the bugs. They update the old kind of things that didn't go right or so well or so fluidly. And I think at the Last Supper in John's gospel, he said very clearly, this is a new covenant in my blood and my body.
Yeah, but do you know what the new covenant, he was quoting something from the Ezekiel and Jeremiah. He was speaking something very specific that he had in mind, what he was initiating there, and it had to do with man's, when he says new covenant, he wasn't saying we should 86 the Old Testament.
I didn't mean that specifically. I'm saying the new does have new things for us.
I agree.
It does abolish and change some things of the old.
I understand that. I agree with you on that.
That's why you and I aren't kosher eaters.
That's correct.
We don't have to make animal sacrifices. And I also believe that in the interest of love, I don't think you can kill someone. It's like you made the analogy in one of your papers, or no, I'm sorry, it was one of your podcasts, saying, well, it's like disciplining a child. You know, small pain now, big pain later.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you would ever kill a child by spanking. You know, you wouldn't discipline a child by killing it through spanking. It might be a pain, and I fully support police force, but
right.
I never, out of love, kill someone.
No, well, that's because we're mixing categories now, because you're right. You don't discipline a child by killing him, but we're not talking about disciplining a child here. We are talking, depending on the circumstances, it might be the execution of appropriate punishment for a capital crime, which Paul himself said, if I have done anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. He didn't take exception with capital punishment. He just said he was not guilty of the crime in question. And there are times sometimes when lethal force is necessary to stop somebody from doing irreparable harm to another innocent person.
So we are assisting God in His judgment.
In that case, it's not an act of judgment. It's an interdiction to keep harm from happening to someone else. It's not assisting Him in judgment. Although there is a case that we do assist God in judgment, and God specifically identifies that in the New Testament as the role of government. That government is an arm of God to punish evildoers and give praise to those who are right. This is in 1 Peter chapter 4, I believe. Or maybe two.
But involve harm in that justice to prevent harm from someone else, we're bringing harm on other people.
Yes, of course. That's exactly the way it works. You stop some criminal from kidnapping someone else by kidnapping him and putting him behind bars. That's exactly how it works.
But in war, you're not kidnapping the actual person. You're kidnapping his countrymen. You're kidnapping his...
No, I was just using an illustration that, you know, of course, you bring harm to the person you're opposing. That's the nature of the action. And so there's nothing wrong with bringing harm to somebody if it's a morally justified harm. And it is not... The issue of love is not the factor that's determined in this case unless...
Every Christian action that I take.
Pardon me?
That is exactly why I came to earth, because God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son.
Well, notice how God put it. He gave His only begotten Son to die. So there's violence and harm that comes to His Son to benefit other people, okay?
Awesome transition to my next point. I think pacifism doesn't do enough. I think what Christians are called to is sacrifice. Martin Luther King was the one that said we must be willing to sacrifice for peace, not just love it. We're peace.
I understand that we must be willing to sacrifice, and sometimes the sacrifice is to bring harm to another evil person. Listen,
that are
Lucky,
sacrifice and not forcing that sacrifice on someone else.
Lucky, if you were there in, you know, Schofield Barracks, and a bunch of bad guys came up to take your life, and I was standing there watching, and I had the capability to stop them using lethal force against them from using lethal force against you, and I did not do it, that would not be an act of love towards you.
What other option is there besides lethal force?
What if there is no other option? Let's just say, what if there is no other option? Sometimes there isn't. I'm not saying you should use
it in the way of the bullet. How about I sacrifice myself as Christ did for your life? That's the greatest gift you can give, is your life.
No, that doesn't do any good at all. And I'll tell you why. In this particular case, in my illustration, wait a minute, Lucky. Here's my illustration. You are about to die, and so what I do is I stand and I take the bullet. Then what happens? You have two corpses, mine and yours. You aren't rescued. The bad guys win. If I have the opportunity to stop them from hurting you, I'm morally obliged to do it, because it is not loving to you for me to take the bullet myself so that I'm dead and then they kill you. Now, I'm not suggesting using lethal force unless it's necessary, but I'm suggesting also there are some times when it's actually necessary, and then it is the morally right thing to do.
I think morals are based off of, I only understand a tiny bit about theology, but I do believe that God created what is moral and what is right and what is justified.
Fair enough, okay. He grounds it.
And that's why I turn to the Bible to define what morals should be.
I agree.
I found that in Matthew 5:44-45, Luke 6:27-28, Luke 6:35, 1 John 3:15, and Matthew 5:21-22.
Okay. Well, it sounds like some of those are Sermon on the Mount passages, and I've already addressed that with the last caller. I mean, just quoting the verses.
5 was.
Pardon me?
Only that first one was Sermon on the Mount. The rest of them, Luke 6:27, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you,
okay.
And again in 6:35.
What about those that are mistreating you? Am I supposed to bless those that are mistreating you? That's the question of war. Lucky?
Yes, I think you're supposed to pray for them.
Okay, fine. You got the last word on that one, and I appreciate the spirited discussion. And thank you for your service, Lucky. Even though you're suffering for the Lord there at Schofield Barracks in Oahu. All the best to you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, that's hour number one behind us, ladies and gentlemen, and hour number two just ahead. So stay tuned for more Clear Thinking Christianity. Stand to reason, ladies and gentlemen, your place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. And I am Greg Kokel, your host, with you every Sunday, 3 until 5. For those listening on podcast, thank you so much. And I know many of you called in, kind of with time warps and all that, because you want to participate. And as did my first caller from last hour from Baghdad, Eugene, and my second caller, with whom we talked a while, also military from Schofield Barracks in Oahu, talking about pacifism. It was very interesting, the contrast of those two phone calls. The first, a person who re-upped for a second tour of duty in that country as a Christian. And the second, now formerly a forward observer for military and combat, and now a conscientious objector who is still serving in the military, to his credit, doing what he can in a peaceful capacity, because as a Christian he thinks it's a mistake for him to take any human life. I hope you, if you didn't listen to that hour, if you're just tuning in now, that you go back and you get the posting, which we'll have up in 2 days since tomorrow's a holiday. And listen to it carefully and listen to the things that are said. And make your own judgment. I guess that's all I can ask you to do. But this next piece that I want to talk about, it is timely. I don't want to put it off, even though I have four callers on. I won't take too much time. But something that's happened recently that does relate to the issue of being in a war zone, or where your body's at risk, as it were, especially in a kind of a religious battle of sorts. And so this raises some odd circumstances, as happened to Steve Sintani and Olaf Wig, Fox News journalists who were kidnapped in Gaza on August 14th and have since been released. Many of you know of these two gentlemen because of the televised act of affirming Allah as God and Muhammad as his prophet, which is the basic statement of faith for all Muslims. They were forced at gunpoint to make this confession, a confession which was spurious. We now know they weren't converted. They did that to save their lives. In fact, one says, this is Sintani, "We were forced to convert to Islam at gunpoint," which raises a question. I actually, in the quote here in the news story, I put convert in quotations, because how, when you're forced to convert, how's that a conversion? It's not really a conversion, right? It's just lip service. "We were forced to convert to Islam at gunpoint." Don't get me wrong here. I have the highest respect for Islam, and I learned a lot of good things about it. He's taken some grief for that comment, by the way. "But it was something we felt we had to do because they had the guns," right? Remember Mao? Persuasion from the barrel of a gun, all right? And we didn't know what the heck was going on. That's what, not exactly what he said, but you get the point. A video was released apparently showing Whig and Santani dressed in beige Arab-style robes. Whig of New Zealand delivered an anti-Western speech, his face expressionless and his tone halting. It reminds me of this one U.S. airman that was shot down, and I can't remember who it was. It was a long time ago, and who did a similar kind of thing. I think the Russians got him. Might have been that U-2 pilot back in the 60s, and as he's making this confession, confessing to war crimes, he's blinking away in Morse code the word torture, just to let everybody know that he was under duress. Anyway, this article says the kidnappers, Muslims, claimed both men had converted to Islam. Are these people stupid? Just say this prayer. It's magic. Say these words, and you're a convert. Don't they have like a kind of a Quran version of James 2? Like words are not enough? Maybe they are in that religion. I don't know. But it's the kidnappers claim both men had converted. Right. Let's see what else I got here. Let's see. Islam is not just meant for some people. This is part of the quote they were forced to say. Santani said this, "It is the true religion for all people at all times. I change my name to Khalid. I have embraced Islam and say the word Allah." That's all you do, huh? Change your name. Say Allah. Well, that satisfied them. They released them. Of course, now they're on Fox News and everywhere else saying that they, you know, just joking. Never mind. Which raises a question, and I will say this up front. I do not fault these two men in the slightest for having done what they did, because we all know they didn't mean it. And, very important, I have no reason to believe that these were followers of Jesus Christ. But what if? What if they were? What if this were you? Do you think you have the freedom, and I'm as serious as a heart attack right now, friends, do you think you have the freedom to go through lip service of affirming Allah, the moon god, as the god, and allegiance to Muhammad as his prophet in denial of the one who's suffered and died for you? Do you think you can do that? And God's going to know, well, you were just joking, you were just kidding, you didn't mean it, never mind. Is that okay for Christians? And I just want to reflect on a couple of things. Like 300 years of blood shed by Christians who faced just exactly that situation in the early part of the Christian era. Recant. Swear by the spirits of Caesar. Bow down before Caesar and we will spare your lives. And instead they were fed to the lions and they were made human torches in Caesar's gardens. Thousands crucified because they didn't recant. Some of you have read the martyrdom of Polycarp, second century Christian disciple of the Apostle John, who was burned at the stake. And this account is quite vivid. You can actually read it on our website at str.org. Just type in Polycarp, P-O-L-Y-C-A-R-P, and you'll get it. He said, "I am a Christian." He couldn't recant. Jesus said, "Do not fear him who can kill the body and not the soul." Who could kill the body and not the soul? Anybody. Don't fear him who can kill you. Fear rather him who can throw both body and soul in hell. And he wasn't talking about the devil. The devil doesn't throw anybody in hell. God throws people in hell. The Father does. Do not consider your life as more important than your testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, I realize that in saying this, that this isn't something that just reporters in Gaza or in Baghdad or anywhere else over there have to face. Because if you're traveling abroad, you can be snatched. And if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you can have a gun put to your head or an axe or a saw. These guys are creative. And be demanded to make the same kind of pledge. Then what? Make up your mind now that you will never recant. Make up your mind that you will not love your life even to the death. That's what it says about the martyrs in the book of Revelation. They did not love their lives even to the death. Do you think these statements, by the way, in Scripture give you some idea of what God expects of us at that time? That he expects that it's not enough to say, well, you know, I was just kidding. I did it to save my life. Yes, you did it. You denied Christ to save your life. Do not fear him who can kill the body, but not the soul. That means there are going to be people that are going to try to kill the body. And Jesus says, don't fear them. Fear rather him who can throw body and soul in hell. Now, I'm not suggesting, because I don't think this is true, that if you're a follower of Christ and actually regenerate and you falter and are weak and you make up a story to save your skin and you deny Christ, that you've committed the unpardonable sin. That's not my view. This was a deal, by the way, right around the time of Constantine, because just before this, there was a heavy persecution 20 years before the Council of Nicaea, the last great persecution there, and there were Christians who recanted and then wanted to come back, and not having paid the price the others who didn't recant had to pay, wanted to receive communion, and there was a big debate. Do we let them back in? And some said yes and some said no. I'm inclined to offer forgiveness from a human perspective, and I think God does in a divine perspective, but that's hardly the point. The point isn't whether, well, if I sin, will God forgive? Yes, but that doesn't give you liberty to sin, especially this one. Now, God willing, I would never be in that position, but you know what? It's not just over there that you're vulnerable, because those guys over there are here. What keeps any of you from being grabbed, even in this country? It could happen. And then what? Video turning, gun at your head, then what? What will you say? I hope you'd say something like, Muhammad is Allah's prophet, but Allah is not God. Jesus is. And one day you will bend your knee before him when he stands before you as judge. As for me, I am a Christian. And by the grace of God, that would be my response if I face that. But we have a better chance of responding properly if we make up our mind now. Though it may never happen, you never know. 1-800-227-5278, and let's go to Victorville and David. Welcome to Stand to Reason, David.
Hey, how are you, Greg?
I'm doing all right, kind of a sober thought, but I'm just recovering from that as I think about these the real possibility that Christians around the world, even in this country, are going to have to give their life for the cause of Christ.
Oh, they've already done that.
They have, sure.
And 800,000 of them in Rwanda that nobody did anything about.
But, yeah.
Interesting talking to your one caller, Lucky. This is off the topic that I had called about. But
Lucky was he doesn't like the word pacifist, but he's kind of stuck with it because that word best describes him as a Christian, right?
I'm a pacifist, too, if that's the case. But there's an excellent website. Actually, if you just go to your Google search engine and type in the name Desmond Doss, D-E-S-M-O-N-D, Doss, D-O-S-S. He's the only conscientious objector to win the Medal of Honor during World War II. If you haven't heard of his story, I would certainly recommend that you look into it because it's quite an interesting story. He is the only, again, he was a medic in during World War II on Okinawa.
Right.
And Iwo Jima, and he's the only, again, he's the only conscientious objector
to the Earned Medal of Honor. And I'm sure the story is a wonderful one, and people would be very, I'm sure, touched and motivated by his sacrifice and what he did under fire. However, of course, whatever he did is not an argument for pacifism or against it, because those things are determined by other issues than someone's sense of self-sacrifice.
Well, that might be true. You know, like I said, I didn't call to argue that point.
Right.
I did listen to your show last week, and you were talking about, I guess it was in the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes, but I listened to most of the rest, about the soul, which was interesting. My question was, is in Genesis 2:7, it's pretty clear that the Lord takes dust of the earth and his breath, and that equals a living soul.
Okay. When and you say
nowhere,
that, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
And I was just going to say, and nowhere in the Bible does it equate that the soul is separate from the spirit.
Well, that I agree with, but I don't know how that helps you. That the words spirit and soul are almost always used interchangeably, so it doesn't identify a separate substance between spirit and soul. But certainly, the spirit and soul are something different than the physical body.
Well, I would disagree, because if you translate the word spirit, if you translate the word breath, both used. Both in the New Testament and both in the Old Testament,
right.
The words mean the same thing.
Yeah, they mean it's the same word that is used for breath. Okay, so what? So you are you suggesting that because it's the same word for both that there's no difference between the two?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. In other words, what I'm saying is that you can't have one without you can't have a living soul without the breath of God. It's impossible. As a matter of fact, the Bible even is very.
Let me back up for just a second here. I mean, you're arguing a physicalist kind of position based on the words that are used to describe soul, but you just use the word breath with regards to God, and you don't think that God breathes, does He?
As a matter of fact, do you think
that God breathes air? O2. He's got lungs and a human body to breathe air. Is that
no? I didn't say that.
No, I know you didn't. I know you didn't. I'm making a different point. Hear me out for a minute, because here's my basic point. Just because the same word is being used in both cases doesn't mean it means exactly the same thing. Most words are equivocal. They have multiple meanings depending on the usage. And the word breath, you're arguing, must be physical. It's not spiritual, because it's the same word for breath. The soul and breath are the same thing. But you just talked about the breath of God. So you are using the word with regards to God, and you certainly don't mean his physical breath. Therefore, it's very possible that the scripture can be using the term in two different ways, just as you are right now. That's my point.
I understand that, but if you go if using that logic, then we can say that God lives in our nose.
No, I'm not using that logic. The logic I'm using is that words have different meanings. I'm not saying that
I understand that. What I'm saying is if we want to use the logic that words have different meanings, then we can suppose that, for example, in Job says that God lives in his nose. We want to take it to that extension of.
Wait a minute. Wait. Back up for a second. Are you denying that words have more than one meaning?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, that's all I'm saying. It has nothing to do with Job's nose at all. I'm just simply saying that it has more than one meaning, but you are using the word univocally. You go to the book of Genesis, and you're questioning the existence of the soul, because the word used of soul there is breath.
No, I'm not.
And breath
I'm
is physical.
I'm not questioning the existence of the soul. I'm saying that. And I are physical living soul. That's what we are.
Well, a soul isn't.
Nowhere in the Bible does it say that the soul is separate from the body. Nowhere.
Well, no, it doesn't use those words precisely, but it does talk about.
It doesn't even use those in.
David, wait. Let me just give you an example. You want a biblical text?
Paul says, use the one in Matthew about the body and the soul being separate?
Why don't you let me use my verse, and then you could respond to it instead of trying to second-guess me. Is that all right?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, Paul said, just to cite one place, that he, in 2 Corinthians, that he was taken up to the seventh heaven. He was, whether in the body or out of the body, I know not. Now, that verse doesn't say the soul is separate from the body, but it is a necessary precondition for that sentence to make any sense. And so, therefore, we draw the conclusion from not just that passage, but from many others, and also just from basic reflection, and I have a whole talk on this issue called The Invisible Man, that the soul is an immaterial substance that is the soul of the ground of my own self, my ego, if you will, my identity, myself, and my body is joined to it in a mysterious fashion, but the body changes in its composition while the soul still remains myself. And so this is consistent with biblical passages like the one I just read, or the biblical passages in the Old Testament against conjuring up dead spirits after the body is already in the ground. That pretty much requires that you have a immaterial self and a physical self called a body as well. So these would be the kind of arguments that I'd advance there.
Right, I understand. But we can take it one step at a time and say, for example, that God was against any sort of divination, witches, warlocks, whatever the case might be.
Yes.
When are we to assume that when Samuel came up out of the ground, that Samuel wasn't in heaven? That in other words, it would be like the situation with Lazarus in the sense that Jesus, when he called out Lazarus, he didn't say come out of heaven. He said come forth out of the grave.
Yeah, but that doesn't address my particular point. When he came out, he was body and soul, one united thing, resurrected in that fashion. But in the case of Samuel, you have Samuel's spirit coming up when his body was in the grave. This verse makes it very, very clear that Samuel's spirit and his body were two different things.
Well, okay, what I'm trying to get at is it wasn't Samuel. I don't believe that that was Samuel. The Lord doesn't use witches to accomplish his goals, does he?
Well, you can go back. Have anybody else go back? God can use anyone to accomplish his goal. He certainly used...
Okay, but
wait, let me answer. You can't keep interrupting, David. If you're going to ask me a question, let me answer it. God used Judas to accomplish his purpose. He can use a witch as well. It was clear if you read the passage that the witch was surprised by what was happening because it was unusual even in her own experience, and that this was Samuel who identified himself as such and told Saul that he will be condemned by God and suffer death the next day along with his two sons, which is exactly what happened. So people can read the text themselves and draw the conclusion they want, but it seems to me this is a great example of a disembodied self, which means that the self is not the same as the body. And I gave another example from the New Testament. If you don't like my Old Testament one, Paul makes this comment.
I disagree with your Old Testament one simply because it's pretty clear in my version, or the way I look at what happened to Samuel, is that that was a ghostly image brought forth by Satan to deceive Saul.
I have actually never heard that characterization in my life about this passage, and anybody who reads this passage, well, then he can foretell the future and then exercise judgment against Saul for God, because that's exactly the way it was taken by the people at the time, and David saw it and understood it that way as well. So, okay, if that's your take on it, fine. It doesn't seem to match with the scriptures, but I don't know. What's your main point is just that the soul is part of, is physical and is part of the body. There is no soul then, essentially. There's just a physical body.
No. I didn't say that. If you read the scripture in Genesis 2:7, it says a living soul.
Well, there's no question
about that. You and I are living souls.
But what you mean by this, the word soul is usually meant to describe the immaterial aspect of man, and you are arguing that that living soul is a physical thing, not an immaterial thing.
Oh, no, not at all, because if you look at your Strong's Concordance, for example, the word soul is used to describe a living thing. It's not used to describe something that's inanimate or just a physical other thing. You look in your Strong's Concordance, it's clear that the word soul...
I guess I don't know, because I don't disagree with the point you're making, although unless you think that living means biological activity. But I guess I don't know what the point... Why don't you do me a favor, David, and just make your point like in one or two sentences real clearly so I can figure out what you're getting at here, because I'm lost now.
My point is that in Genesis 7, it says...
2:7.
2:7. That it says that the Lord takes the dust of the earth,
yes,
and his breath, which is the oxygen, the air that is around the earth.
Okay, wait. His breath is oxygen? God's breath is oxygen. Is that what you just said?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
God breathes oxygen then. Or are you saying that he's using the term to mean oxygen?
No. Don't try to read in what I'm saying. I'm just saying.
I'm trying to understand what you're saying, David, because it's very unclear. So I'm passing it off for you to see. You can tell me whether I got it right or not. Apparently, I'm getting it wrong again. So go ahead.
God's breath is the air that he created.
Okay.
The wind. That's what Urach means.
I understand it can
wind,
mean wind.
Air. It's used as. It's the same word that's spirit as well. It's also the same word again. Pneuma is used for spirit and breath in the New Testament.
This I know very well.
Sure.
I don't see how it makes you.
All I'm saying is that God takes that air, that breath, and gives it to us along with our physical bodies and makes a living soul. Would you be alive without breath?
My body wouldn't be, but I would be, because someday my body will stop breathing, but I will remain.
Well, but that's not scriptural.
Really?
Of course not.
To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord.
No. It's and to be present with the Lord, not is. There is a difference between the word and is. You know that. You're talking about...
Don't patronize me, David.
I'm just telling you, Greg.
Of course, I know the difference between and is.
Okay, then
and
quote
is.
Scripture correctly then.
To be absent from the body is to be present.
Let me ask you a question. Does Paul say when that exchange happens?
In that passage, I don't know that he does.
Of course not. He doesn't say that. So, Paul, you know, I would rather be absent from the body and present with the Lord also. But it's clear from Scripture that we're not present with the Lord until he raises us on the last day.
Okay.
What's the point of having a resurrection and a new body?
Okay, David, I'm going to let you go with this. You've got the last word. I got to go to break, and to be honest with you, I'm just getting a little tired of this one. Thank you for your call, and we'll have more calls. We got Rodney in New Zealand coming up in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. It's Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel, The Stand to Reason, and this is a wonderful song. That Thing You Do, you know the movie? This was written like 30 years after the Beatles, and it sounds just like them, doesn't it? I mean, if you grew up in that era, you knew the early Beatles sound, and that's it. The problem with this song is that I can't get it out of my mind once I get it in, so That Thing You Do. Let's see, this week's Frapper winner. Actually, we have 2 weeks in a row because I was gone last week. I was up in somewhere north of here, Gilroy and San Jose. So last week's Frapper winner is Michael Borich of Springfield, Missouri. Congratulations, Michael. And we also have from the UK for this week, Peter Abbotton in Romford, United Kingdom. So congratulations to both of you who are listeners on our podcast. And for those of you wondering what this is all about, Frapper is a map that you can put a flag on to indicate that you are somewhere in the world listening to our show. And from that list, we draw every week for a free gift and send them out. Just identifies you as a member of our community. In fact, what's happened sometimes is you can blow that list up and the map up and then look kind of like just in your state or even in your community and see how many other standaries and listeners there are there. And some have formed kind of informal fellowship with the other standaries and kindred spirits in their area. So you can use that for that. How do you find it? You go to SDR.org and then punch the podcast, and then the Frapper map will come up and you can register and put your name in the bag at the same time. A book recommendation, especially in light of that last phone call, that will help work through all of these issues, is a book called Body and Soul by J.P. Moreland and Scott Ray. That's Scott Ray, R-A-E, Moreland, M-O-R-E-L-A-N-D, Body and Soul. And this is where they make the full case for mind-body dualism, which is the philosophic descriptor of the discussion we were having a little bit earlier. And there are people who, they're rare, but argue that the way that it seemed like my last caller, David, was arguing, and that was as what's called a non-reductive physicalist. Anyway, maybe I misunderstood entirely what was going on there, but I had a hard time figuring out what was up. In any event, let's go on to New Zealand and Rodney. Hey, Rodney. How you doing, mate?
Nick, how are you?
Good, thank you, sir. Are you the same folk? Are you the same Kiwi that has called in the past?
Yes, I am. Yes, that's me.
Good to hear from you again.
Now, I'll go easy on you. I don't want to make you tired like your last caller.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I probably shouldn't have said that. But anyway, it's kind of a parting shot, I guess, but I was frustrated. So my apologies. Go ahead, Rod.
No, that's all right. Hey, love your decision-making and the will of God.
Thank you.
Real. One of the most common objections that you get is when somebody wants to share their testimony about how they have heard from.
Mm-hmm. It is not only the one of the most common objections. It is the only objection, just about, because it is almost non-existent that people will actually make a biblical case against the decision-making material that I offer there, because I work through the Bible passages very carefully, and people never have taken exception with my exegesis. They always, if they disagree, will cite an experience. Well, if what you say is true, Kokel, then explain this. And of course, I don't exegete experiences, so I don't even chase that rabbit trail, but this is what happens all the time with me. You're right.
Right, which is my question. Why don't you exegete experience?
Because let's just say that any given experience by a person is veridical. In other words, it's true as far as they've given it. What conclusion do we draw in terms of theology regarding Christian experience in general from that experience? What is the appropriate conclusion to draw with regards to theology from somebody's experience, even granted that it was true? That is, they said happened actually happened.
Granted it's true, then wouldn't that make it an example of special revelation and therefore from God?
Okay. Let's just say that was the case. What does that then? What follows with regards to my point in decision making about theological application for Christians in general? Because keep in mind, my statements on the decision making tape have to do with what the Bible teaches is the appropriate way for Christians to make decisions and to expect God to interact with them. All right? And so given that I am making a biblical case and somebody offers me my experience and it turns out that it is veridical and therefore is an example of special revelation to that person, then what is the theological application for you and I?
Yeah, I see your point.
I mean, the simple answer is there is no theological application for you and I. What all we end up saying is, okay, God spoke to you, but what does that have to do with me? It doesn't have anything to do with me. It shows that God can speak, but it doesn't show that he must or that he will or that everyone can expect to. You know, any person who has an experience with God, that experience could be a valid, legitimate experience for that person, but we don't draw the conclusion that everybody ought to have that experience just in virtue of the experience itself. You need a theological case in order to make that further step. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying? I have a feeling like I'm not communicating too well.
No, the problem is that I agree with you. I'm trying to act devil's advocate. And
okay. So, okay, let me ask, then tell me what, okay, I'm making a statement about Christian conduct in general and what is, or what a theological position or views or conclusions in general. So if I agreed with you that there is an illustration or rather an experience that is completely veridical, and then you say, yes, well, this would show that it's a bona fide revelation from God, to which I would agree. That was really my point in saying that it was true. It was, in fact, this thing. Then what? Now we conclude what? What do we conclude from that experience?
Would it not be reasonable to conclude that God does speak through the Holy Spirit, and that if obviously when he wants to, he can and does?
Yes, but I have never taken exception with that particular point, Rodney. That I've always affirmed, that God does speak through it. He can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. I've always said that. And so to have an example of God doing that is, to me, is totally consistent with my model. The problem is when people give their experience is they are drawing theological conclusions about Christian behavior from that and habit and theology and Christian discipline. And they say, God spoke to me, therefore that's the way that most people should get their guidance on a regular basis, and this is the way we all can hear from God if we just listen. Well, see, that's an entirely different statement there. Those two things, that we all can hear from God if we just listen, and that this is the way we get guidance. Those are two different statements that the experience, even if veridical, does not substantiate. You see my point?
Yeah.
I mean, what if I look at Elijah? Or maybe it was Elisha, I get the two mixed up, floated an axe head, right? Do you remember that from the Old Testament? Somebody lost their axe head in the river, and he kind of did a little deal, and up it came, and it floated on the surface. They plucked it out, put it back on, and started chopping wood again. Okay, now, what if I said, no, I think that actually happened. What if I said, let's just pretend that that was just, well, see, that one's in the scripture, so it ennobles that illustration a little bit more on its own. But let's just say you had an axe head that floated. You lost your axe head and it floated to the surface after you prayed. Okay? Now, you could learn from that God answered your prayer. Fair enough. It was a miracle in response to prayer, and God listens to prayer. But you wouldn't want to draw any theory. You wouldn't want to establish any doctrines about floating axe heads, you know? Or maybe about telekinesis or something like that. Oh, man, I found it now. This is it. You want to... Everybody should have the gift of floating axe heads, because every time you lose something in the water, you can just get them to float right up, you know? I mean, that would be kind of silly, wouldn't it? Because God acted in a circumstance does not establish a doctrine regarding that thing. It just establishes the providence of God in that circumstance. That's my point.
Yeah.
I have never said that God can't speak or won't speak or doesn't speak. I never said that. What I have done is take an exception of the teachings of others with regards to spiritual disciplines they are advancing, which disciplines are not taught in the scriptures. That's a whole different thing.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, it does. It does. Now, there's a well-respected teacher down this way called David Riddell, and he puts it very well when it comes to decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
If you take your child to the playground, you tell them they have to stay within the playground. Outside of the playground is the road. You can you can get hurt.
Right.
But within the playground, you're free to do whatever you want. And it wouldn't make sense for the child to come up to you and say, look, Daddy, I've finished playing on the swings now. What do you want me to play on next?
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a good analogy.
Yes, I think that is, but it's not forceful because it's analogy. It's forceful because it captures the biblical teaching on it. And I agree with that. Thank you. I think it's a great analogy. The thing we have to be careful about with analogies, because both sides can give analogies. It's like the guy who says, well, you know, if you're working in front of your computer and your wife is talking to you behind you and you're so focused on the computer, you're going, you know, kind of giving her lip service, but you're not really listening. And that's the same way it is with God. God's talking to you, but we're not listening, and so we don't hear what he's saying. That's another illustration. The thing about illustrations is they can be compelling in themselves, but they're not really arguments. They are merely illustrating something else. And so the thing that you're illustrating has to be substantiated biblically. Is the computer illustration characterized in the Bible? I mean, does God whisper and people don't hear him because they're not listening? That's not in the Bible. I think the illustration that you just described captures something that is taught in the Bible, and that is very specifically that God gives us freedom to work within boundaries, and he defines the boundaries, and then we're free to move within there. And that seems to be the practice of the apostles and whatever. So that's completely consistent with the way I read the scriptures.
Right.
A good illustration.
Right.
Okay, Rodney, thank you for your
work.
Pardon me?
I'll say keep up the good work.
Will do, and I hope I can come down to your fine country again pretty soon. I missed my trip last year, or actually earlier this spring, but I've been down twice. And are you in Auckland or where about? North Island, South Island?
A few hours south of Auckland, a little town called Tauranga.
Okay.
But we'd love to see you down this way.
Well, keep an eye on my schedule, and if I get scheduled again, I'll let you know in advance, and then I'll probably be doing some things in Auckland. If you're only a couple hours away, maybe we can meet.
That would be great.
Okay, Rodney, all the best.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that makes it time for a break. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. We'll be back with more Clear Thinking after this.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
We've had some fun. Yes, we've had our ups.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every weekend, Sundays 3 to 5. I'm going to jump quickly back in the calls. We've got a couple of people here who have been waiting for a while, and I want to try to do my best to get to them. And Kurt in Tucson, thanks for your patience. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah, I almost fell asleep here waiting.
Well, how could you fall asleep when you're listening to the show? Come on. I know you're just joking.
Reference to the first two callers.
Yeah, on war and peace and right. Pacifism and the like.
Right, and I called a couple months ago and we talked about this a little bit last time, and we went over the verses you were discussing here, the Sermon on the Mount, and I was going to address this one and maybe another one.
Okay.
And I don't know if your interpretation of that Sermon on the Mount passage is correct or verifiable or not, as far as you know, the reliability of the way you interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And just for the sake of people who weren't listening, where Jesus says, you know, turn the other cheek, he's talking about a person. It looks like he's talking about somebody giving an insult, because if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, and the only way to do that with a right-handed person is to backhand them, and there's more argument for that, but I just so people are up to speed, he is not teaching pacifism. He's teaching don't take personal retribution to insults, which was the problem he was facing.
My point about that, and I disagree with a lot of conservative Christians on quite a few things, and I think this is one of the situations that they use to hijack the Christian faith to their...
Okay, well, let's not deal with the whole hijacking of the faith. Let's deal with a specific thing that has to do with the war question.
Okay, the right hand, you said, okay, the right, if somebody slaps you on your right cheek, is it right, your right cheek?
Yes.
Okay, they have to use your, you have to use your right...
If you're using your right hand to do that, that's a backhand.
This was before the knee, unless you want to use that as a significant issue as far as the right and the left and all that.
Well, only for this reason.
Two verses before that, Jesus said, uses the right eye. If the right eye offends thee, cut it off, gouge it out, and then if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off.
Obviously hyperbole.
Significance to the right reference in those passages?
Say it again?
Or is it okay? Because you can sin with your left eye and sin with your left.
I'm not sure why he uses right in those particular passages. I'm not sure why. And then maybe he's continuing a pattern with right.
Because it's not significant unless you can provide some meaningful interpretation that he uses for the right eye and the right hand.
Okay, here's the...
For the right cheek, then you have a point. Otherwise, it's just the reference. I think they used right more commonly than left.
Okay, let me offer another thought on it. And don't forget the part that my comments play in the larger picture. I'm arguing against pacifism per se here, not in favor of any particular action, and I would also argue in favor of capital punishment in principle. So I'm arguing in favor of war, lethal action and capital punishment in principle. You know, given circumstances may be determined by given circumstances, and maybe you don't apply that. But my argument is that God is not a pacifist. The God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament are the same gods, and it's clear that God had 22 offenses for capital punishment in the Old Testament and many times sent his people to war. So in principle, he's not a pacifist. The question is whether Jesus changed the entire ethic. And all of that hinges almost entirely on this comment by Jesus. And I think that's causing this comment to do a whole lot of work that Jesus didn't appear to intend it to do, and I'm offering an alternate way to understand this, especially when he's faulting people who are using an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth theology, when that is God's theology, not man's theology. If you go back to the book of Exodus, you'll see the lex talionis, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's a principle of justice that the punishment must fit the crime, and people are quoting that in a way that Jesus is disagreeing with, and that's why my interpretation seems to fit that concern.
The only way that you can make it say what you want to say is by...
I'm not trying to make it say what I want to say.
Pointing out that he stroked the right... cheek.
No, you didn't listen to my comment there.
I did, but I don't. That's, you said that it hinges on this passage here, but only if you take that into meaning that the right cheek means...
No, not at all.
It means an insult as opposed to a more violent...
Not at all. Let me just say it again very quickly. I said, here is the pattern of the Scriptures, and somebody points to this verse as changing the entire pattern of the Scriptures. And I'm saying, it doesn't seem to do that, and here are some alternate ways to understand it, but it doesn't just hinge on that, and I'm not trying to make the Scripture say what I want it to say, because I didn't invent all the Scriptures
That is one way you do have to spin the verse to make it say what you want to say.
I don't even have to refer to that at all. I can point to all of the passages in the Old Testament.
Okay, just go down just a few more verses, and you'll see that Jesus said, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do them good to them that hate you.
Yes, but that doesn't obviate capital punishment or war.
And bring forth to you that view that you hold one bit. That enforces my view more than the one that you want to.
Okay, so you think that if I see a baby being tormented and I don't use the kind of act, well, I don't use, and I use any action against that person who's tormenting the baby, that this is not an exact example of loving them. See, what you just described, the interpretation you offered, doesn't allow any action.
About personal retaliation.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I'm with you on that.
Okay.
I'm with you on that. But war isn't personal retaliation.
But, okay, you...
War is self-defense or defending other innocents. That's a different situation.
To some degree. I think for Christians to be pro-war is quite a different thing, especially in the situation that we're in now, because it wasn't a situation where we had to go to war, and I think most Christians do agree that this is a good thing to do.
Well, then they might be wrong in this particular war. That's a different discussion, but that's not the discussion I'm having right now. I'm not defending this discussion. I am pro-war in principle because I think sometimes in a fallen world this is necessary, just as like I'm pro-violence in principle, and I'm pro-kidnapping in principle. That's what we do when we lock somebody up. I mean, I'm pro-punishment in principle,
but
things have to be properly... Yes, of course.
And I have a hard time believing why a Christian would be pro-death penalty.
Lex talionis, the punishment fits the crime. It's a biblical principle, and there's nothing in the New Testament that disallows such a thing.
Absolutely.
Paul said that that Caesar doesn't bear the sword for anything, for nothing, and Caesar wasn't using the sword to spank with.
So in your viewpoint, if we have a Hitler as a president, in charge of the government, we should bow down and do it.
How did anything that I've said so far promote that idea? I'm just arguing that capital punishment is an option.
That's a passage that's used. He was referring to being submissive to the government authorities at that
time. That's right. And there is a place to do so.
To, submitting yourself.
I think we should have. Wait, look, if I was in Nazi Germany.
Right.
If I was in Nazi Germany, I should obey the traffic laws, but I shouldn't obey them when they tell me to turn over to Jews for destruction. So.
If you're a Christian and you're on your way to heaven, why would you want to kill somebody who's on his way to hell? Why wouldn't you want to give him the most amount of time possible on this life?
Well, it has nothing to do with what I would want to do. It has to do with what the circumstance demands and what the scriptures allow and sometimes require. That if I am watching the helpless be persecuted and I can protect the helpless from being killed and give them a chance at salvation by taking the life of the bad guy, then I have a moral obligation to do that.
Somebody on death row. Who can't harm anybody anymore at that point.
That's okay. Well, that is.
Why would you be for calling for the head of that person?
Because the scripture requires that. The scripture allows such a thing, and it's an appropriate expression of justice. It's also a deterrent.
So God cannot avenge in the afterlife, like he said.
Of course, but golly, okay. I'm just going to respond. Wait, Kurt. I'm going to respond to your last comment. Then I got to go to another caller because this kind of thing is said all the time, and it bugs the heck out of me. I'm taking God's vengeance into my hand. No, God has delivered into the hands of government the responsibility to execute His vengeance. That is absolutely clear in Scripture from the beginning all the way through the New Testament. God has ordained government to do such a thing. And the only alternative for people like you is anarchy. If we aren't to do any of those things, because every time if you slap somebody on the wrist, you can say, wait a minute, you're taking God's vengeance. The government is supposed to do that. That's their job. And when they don't do that, then culture is suffered as a result of it. Got to go to another caller. Let's go to Mike in Little Rock. Mike, welcome to the Stand to Reason.
Hi.
Hi, I'm sorry for jumping in so quickly on you here.
That's okay.
Surprise, surprise.
I was calling about your decision-making, decision-making in the will of God.
Mm-hmm.
And hang on, I got a barking dog here.
Uh-oh, okay.
All right.
What can I help you with in that, Mike?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago I called. We are supported staff with a ministry organization, and
mm-hmm.
and it's big on establishing your call,
right,
and writing up the calling testimony before you go through all that. And my
right.
wife and I did that a few years ago and thought for sure that that's what it was, but now we've seen our support drying up, and so we were kind of came to a brick wall and didn't
mm-hmm.
know what to do. So we went and got that book, and it's been amazing.
On decision-making?
Yes.
The one by Gary Friesen, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
Decision-Making and the Will of God.
Right, and that's helped you a bit, huh?
Quite a bit.
Good.
And it's just freeing and liberating now. That so we've decided to leave supported staff and go back into secular work.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when I called a couple weeks ago, I was just wanting to find guidance and direction.
Uh-huh.
And
is that when I challenge you to maybe read the book or listen to some of our material?
No, actually, I didn't actually get through because you had a guest the second hour.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
But I got on the website and found the name. I couldn't remember the name of the book. Found the book and went to the bookstore here and got it, and has been... I didn't want to just read a book and say, oh, yeah, that's my answer.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to make sure that it was grounded in Scripture. And
well,
I spent a lot of time as I was reading, going back and looking at the Scripture that was being referenced. And
uh-huh. And you know, this is one thing about Gary Friesen's book on decision-making is it's a lot thicker than any other book on finding God's will. And the reason it's so thick is because he exegetes the passages. He just doesn't quote a verse and give an experience, which is frankly what most of the books do.
Yeah.
And did it seem to you that he was being pretty fair and even-handed with the text in question?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah,
I want to make sure that, you know, there's no twisting or quoting out of context or anything going on. And now I just wanted to call and relate to you my experience now.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've already made the decision.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And you know, he makes the point there in his book that, you know, he was asked when he started ministry, please describe your call. And he had two questions. He said, what is that? And where in the Scripture is it required? And, of course, nobody had an idea where it was required because it's not. And the Great Commission seems to be pretty enough adequate. But he said nobody really had a clear idea of what it was. I mean, it was kind of a sense or a subjective thing or an awareness or something like that. And so it's like they didn't want to send out people into ministry unless they had this thing that wasn't required from Scriptures and they didn't know exactly what it was. But if people say, you know from being there, people say, oh, man, I really felt the Lord and we were praying and I just had this sense and bada boom, then they're satisfied.
Right.
You know, and that's all that's required, even if it turns out that your support is drying up like you suggested, you know.
Right. There's a point where you got to face, I mean, there's the, I guess, the theoretical and then the here's real life.
Mm-hmm.
You get to real life, we have four kids that need to be fed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm required, that's another point he brings out, is you're required to provide for your family. And you can do that through support, but when it's not there, then...
Sure. I mean, that's a very practical thing that God in his sovereign leading, if you will, his sovereign plan, used to redirect you according to his purposes in some entirely different way. But you didn't have to kind of hunker down and try to hear his voice or kind of decipher the signs. You know, I'm so glad to hear your word on this and your testimony because... your story, because a lot of people are really frustrated about this and they don't know what's going on. And I've heard that when they listen to either our material and Decision-Making the Will of God, or From Truth to Experience, also at Stand to Reason, or the book by the same other title, From Decision-Making the Will of God by Gary Friesen, any of those things, and then they, you know, they work through it. All of a sudden, they experience a tremendous sense of freedom. And it's really, really... you know, like you're saying, it's very satisfying and freeing, and it helps them to be much more productive for the Lord.
Right. I felt I had the weight of the world on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. I felt I was letting my family down.
Yeah.
But I had this call there that we're here to do God's work. We've got to stay and stick with this, or we're out of God's will. We're, you know, Friesen talks about the dot.
Yeah.
The traditional view.
You got to hit
find that dot.
Right. You got to hit the center of the target or you're in big trouble. Mike, thanks so much for the call. We're out of time here, but God bless you in your efforts now, because I know you'll continue to serve God in this new capacity as best as you're able. That's it for our show today, ladies and gentlemen, and a lively one. Think about the arguments. Maybe I got a little too lively at some of the callers, so... my fault. I guess it's just one of those days for me. First I got the waitress, the hostess, and then I kind of nailed a couple callers. All right, well, maybe we'll do better next week. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go out and you give them heaven this week, my friends. Bye-bye now.